Turning now to the book of the prophet Isaiah, chapter 7. The book of the prophet Isaiah, chapter 7, and verse 1. And it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up toward Jerusalem to war against it, but could not prevail against it. And we've just embarked upon recently a survey of the book of the prophet Isaiah. We've come to this seventh chapter, and I really would like to go through the book much more speedily than this, but tonight I feel obliged to focus on these two chapters, 7 and 8, because they are so foundational to the rest of the book, and they are so rich and so astonishing. Here are remarkable prophecies. Prophecies about nations. Prophecies, of course, about the Messiah. So we shall slow down just a little and look at these two pivotal chapters. Well, they're the days of Ahaz, 731 BC to 715 BC. A 16-year evil reign, as you know, of Ahaz, father of Hezekiah. Hezekiah, one of the most conspicuous good kings. Ahaz, one of the very worst kings of Judah. 12th king of Judah. A man who greatly promoted Baal worship, built countless Baal altars, perverted the land and the people, even presided over the sacrifice of children by fire. A terrible, awful man, and disobedient to God in every way. Well, now Syria and Israel, the northern kingdom, which is also called in this passage Ephraim. Ephraim stands for Israel in the chapters of Isaiah, though Ephraim was only one of the 10 northern tribes, but the largest of them, so her name tends to get put often in place of Israel, the northern kingdom. Now the northern, the disobedient, or the most disobedient kingdom anyway, had turned against Judah in the south. And for this reason, that Israel and Syria also, normally enemies, were being marauded and threatened by Assyria. Assyria was the regional overlord, as you know. The Assyrian Empire is in full swing. Tiglath-Pileser III is the emperor, the king of Assyria and her empire. And the land of Israel and the land of Syria, they want the help of Judah to defend themselves against the mighty Assyria. But down in Judah, Ahaz, the disobedient to God Ahaz, is playing quite a different game. He wants the help of Assyria to protect him against Israel and Syria. So there is a collision. And there it is, Pekah, Ahaz, rather, the king of Judah, wants the help of Assyria, and Israel in the north and Syria, they want to depose Ahaz, king of Judah, and install a puppet king of their own in Judah so that they can marshal the very large forces of Judah to help them repel Assyrian advances. Of course, none of them are thinking in a godly way. Not Israel, not Judah either. Judah should be trusting the Lord and casting themselves upon him in prayer. But no, Ahaz is an evil king, and he wants to settle his problems by worldly politics, and that has already got him into serious trouble. It came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up toward Jerusalem to war against it, but could not prevail against it. Let's just go for a parallel passage for a few moments. In 2 Chronicles chapter 28, verses 1 to 6, Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, but he did not that which was right in the sight of the Lord, like David his father. For he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, and made also molten images for Baalim. Moreover, he burnt incense in the valley of the son of Hinnom, and burnt his children in the fire, after the abominations of the heathen, whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. He sacrificed also and burnt incense in the high places, and on the hills, and under every green tree. Wherefore the Lord his God delivered him into the hand of the king of Syria, and they smote him, and carried away a great multitude of them, the men of Judah, captives, and brought them to Damascus, and he was delivered into the hand of the king of Israel, who smote him with a great slaughter. And then the details of that slaughter are given. But somehow, they did not entirely overcome Judah, those two other kingdoms. And so you come back to Isaiah chapter 7, and that's all over, and Ahaz has somehow got away and is free and is reigning and ruling back again in Jerusalem. But they've lost so many men of war that then the rumour comes that Syria and Israel are getting into confederacy again with a new plan to attack them. So there's terror in Judah. Verse 2, and it was told the house of David, saying, Syria is confederate with Ephraim, Israel. And his heart was moved, that is to say, he was terrified, Ahaz. And the heart of his people, as the trees of the wood, are moved with the wind. There was just one great wave of fear went through the land. Now, he did not send for Isaiah the prophet. It's very significant that in verse 3 of this Isaiah chapter 7, then said the Lord unto Isaiah, go forth now to meet Ahaz, thou and Sheer-Jashub, thy son, who was just about a schoolboy, and meet them at the end of the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the fuller's field. So God speaks to Isaiah, and he tells him where he can locate Ahaz. And he was, one would imagine, inspecting the main source of water for the city of Jerusalem. How can this be defended? How can this be maintained? We don't want any attackers, invaders, to cut the city off from its main water supply. Meet him at that point, exactly where there was a sort of little industrial development of fullers who cleaned newly made fabric and so on. The details are astonishing, recorded here. And here's the message that Isaiah must give to the evil king. Verse 4, say unto him, take heed, listen very carefully, and be quiet. Stop this fear, don't be afraid, neither be faint-hearted, because obviously it is a terrifying situation. For the two tails of these smoking firebrands, well, very insulting language really, he's being told that they're finished. They're finished and they're doomed. You've nothing to fear from Syria and Israel. In spite of what they managed to do to you before, they're petering out and they're coming to grief themselves. So don't be afraid of the fierce anger of Rezin with Syria and of the son of Remaliah. Well, Pekah is not even named from now on because he wasn't of royal descent. He was a usurper. He shouldn't have been on the throne of Israel. And that's probably the reason why Isaiah only refers to him from now on as Remaliah's son and not by his name. But here in verse 5, because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Remaliah have taken evil counsel against thee, saying, and Isaiah knows all about it. How did he find out this intelligence confined to Ahaz and the royal court? But Isaiah tells him what's been happening between those other nations in verse 6. Let us go up against Judah and vex it, and let us make a breach therein for us, and set a king in the midst of it, a puppet king, even the son of Tabeel. Thus saith the Lord God, it shall not stand, neither shall it come to pass. And there's a probably difficult to follow figure of speech employed in verse 8. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Which means this, that the head of Syria is Damascus, and as though to say, Syria is all that Damascus will reign. She'll never reign over Judah. should never take Judah. They're finished. And the head of Damascus is reason. He'll only have Damascus, he'll only have Syria. And he won't have that for long, Isaiah will go on to say. It isn't going to stand. But here is a tremendous word in the second part of verse 8. And within 65 years, 65 years, shall Ephraim, that is Israel, be broken, that it be not a people. Well, within a few years, Samaria was going to fall and would be no more. And her walls would be broken down, Samaria, the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. But within the next 50 years, other very significant things would happen, because the conquering Assyrians would adopt a policy of taking captive more and more people from Israel and deporting them and replacing them with people brought in from other lands that they had conquered. So, yes, it wouldn't just be a case of Samaria being brought to the ground in a matter of 15 years. Within another 50 years after that, Israel, the tribe of Ephraim and most of those people wouldn't be there at all. They'd all be moved with a massive population exchange carried out by the Assyrians. And that literally came to pass. And that's one of the great population movements of the region that was to take place in those days. Well, the second part of verse 8 again, within 65 years shall Ephraim be broken, that it be not a people, just dispersed all over the place and replaced in the land. So the same figure of speech, verse 9, and the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son. He's not going any further than that. Now the second part of verse 9 is something I want to tell you about. It's so very important. Look at these words. If ye will not believe, surely ye shall not be established. These are the words of God given through Isaiah to Ahaz. But look, they're not to Ahaz, because if you're reading an authorized version, you see these words, if ye will not believe. Surely, now, it wouldn't be ye if these were words of Isaiah to Ahaz only, it would be you, if you will not believe. Now here's the interesting thing, and one of the advantages of an old-fashioned Bible translation. If you had on your lap a modern Bible translation, an NIV or an NASB or practically anything else, you would read, if you will not believe. And you will naturally assume that Isaiah is warning Ahaz. And then you won't understand what follows very well. And many people don't. But one of the advantages of our archaic terms here is that you know that Isaiah is now talking to the nation. He's confronting Ahaz, but he is talking generally to the house of Judah. If ye, the people, it's a plural term, will not believe. That's why if you have a modern translation, and it is would be very nice if we had something of the quality of the authorized version in more modern English, but it would be very important that where ye is thrown out and becomes you, if it's plural, referring to a lot of people, more than one, then it should be somehow distinguished. Maybe the U in capital letters, so that you immediately know this is not just spoken to an individual, this is spoken to all of them. And you'd see the difference. That's disguised by modern English, and it's very valuable in this old-fashioned version. Well, here you are. Anyway, let's go to the point of it. In verse 9, the second part, if ye, Judah, the nation, will not believe, surely ye, the nation, not just the king, it's true of him, but it's true of them all, shall not be established. Now, once you get that ye is to everybody, then you see the significance of what follows. Verse 10, moreover, the Lord spake again unto Ahaz. By the way, many people think that this is not Isaiah speaking now, but the very voice of God is heard. But that's not necessarily the case. It may be now a new inspiration of Isaiah, still through him. But anyway, the point is this, verse 11. Ask thee a sign of the Lord thy God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. Ahaz, if you doubt this word, you can ask for a sign which is amazing. Something moving in the skies, in the heavens. Some great miracle. This is an important thing. Why, the king and the whole nation is being called to obedience, not to make any confederacy, any arrangement with Assyria, but to trust the Lord. It is a pivotal moment in the history of the nation. The theocracy is at stake. If Ahaz and Judah fail at this point and disobey the Lord and use their own wisdom and make a worldly alliance, an evil alliance, then the nation will not be established. It'll be the last straw. It'll be the final sin. History will go on, but from now on, and of course it is already sealed, from now on the history of Judah will be quite lost and doomed. So here's a pivotal moment. Ask a sign. Because what you're about to do, if you only knew it, Ahaz, will take the nation in one direction or the other forever. It's very pivotal and important. And so Ahaz in verse 12 replies, I will not ask, neither will I tempt the Lord. And we know why this is, because possibly he has already sent his ambassadors to Assyria to do a deal with them. Or he is about to do so, and he's not going to change his policy. I'm turning to 2 Kings chapter 16, just for a moment or so. I read verse 5. Then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to war, and they besieged Ahaz, but could not overcome him. All right, now Isaiah has gone to... They did overcome him for a time, but not finally. He was taken off to Damascus. Many people died. He lost most of his army. But somehow, they didn't finally overcome him, as I said. Then there is this interview with Isaiah, and either just before or just afterwards, verse 7. So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, number 3, king of Assyria, saying, I am thy servant and thy son. Come up and save me out of the hand of the king of Syria and out of the hand of the king of Israel, which rise up against me. And look what he did. And Ahaz took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasures of the king's house and sent it for a present to the king of Assyria. And the king of Assyria hearkened unto him. And he went and he took Damascus. But he took the money too, and a little while later he was to come back for more. So this was a foolish thing to do, but it was a godless thing to do. And I go back to Isaiah chapter 7. Now, here is in verse 12, Ahaz says, I will not ask, neither will I tempt the Lord. And look at verse 13. And he, Isaiah, said, Hear ye now, O house of David. You see, this isn't just a talk between Isaiah and Ahaz. What has happened is a momentous thing, a mammoth thing, and it's affecting the whole of Judah. Hear ye now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men? But will ye weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel, God with us. Now let me tell you why I've been emphasizing this ye, and that this is such an important thing, and a mammoth thing. Do you know what people say? They look at this passage and they say, but this can't really be a prophecy of Christ. What do we fasten on this passage for and say, look, a virgin shall conceive. It was in prophecy that Christ would be born of a virgin. This has nothing to do with prophecy. It's something being conducted between Isaiah and Ahaz. No, it isn't. If you notice, Isaiah is speaking not just to Ahaz, he's speaking to the house of Judah. And Ahaz, on behalf of the house of Judah and all the people, has rejected the warning of God, has rejected even a sign to help them and to preserve their nation, is going anyway into alliance with the enemies of God. And this is a great thing. And so in this context, they're told, in effect, well, there will be a sign. There's a great sign coming. And this sign, it's not tomorrow, it's not next week or next month. It's down in time, but a tremendous sign is coming for the last remnant of Judah when God sends the Saviour. There'll be no more significant dealings until that time. You've rejected the kingdom, you've rejected the sign, here's the next great sign and blessing. You see, the history of Judah will be remnant and return. This is the message of the book of Isaiah. This is why his child, his son, is called a remnant shall return. Did you wonder why Isaiah was told to take his little boy with him when he went to meet the king of Judah? Why did he have to have him with him? What part would he play? Well, his name. Shear Jashub, his name, a remnant shall return. Ahaz probably already knew that he called his boy a remnant shall return. And that was an irritation to him. But I like to think that it was worse than that for King Ahaz, that he condescendingly, like our politicians do today, tapped the little boy on the head and said, "What's your name, son?" And the boy looked up and said, "A remnant shall return, sir," which is the last thing he wanted to hear. And that boy's name was a message, and that's why he was involved in this interview. And that's the message of Isaiah. There'll be rebellion, and eventually, and it happens cycle after cycle, it was going to happen with Assyria coming and raiding 701, the defeat of Judah, the falling of the walled cities, the preservation only of Jerusalem in the middle of everything, a remnant saved. It would happen with the Babylonian captivity, all the Jews taken, a remnant would return to Jerusalem after 70 years. It would happen again and again through the intertestamental period until there was the Roman conquest and occupation. And then would come the Saviour, and the last remnant would be drawn out, and that's the remnant of Jews that were engrafted into the Church of Jesus Christ. And then the Jewish nation would lose their position and their station, and it would be the Jewish Gentile Church of Jesus Christ from that moment on. So a remnant shall return. The doctrine of the remnant, the success. And of course Christ has got to come. There always must be a remnant. All the Jews cannot be rejected until Christ comes, because the divine seed is in the nation and it has to be preserved until Christ is born, and then the Jewish nation is laid aside entirely. Well, perhaps I'm going a little too slowly. But now, if we come down to verse 13, well, I read that, verse 14. "Therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel, God with us." But perhaps I ought to just, for a little digression, take you to chapter 8 and verse 7. Look at how Emmanuel appears again. We'll come back to chapter 7. But how he appears again in this prophecy. Verse 7 of chapter 8. "Now therefore, behold, the Lord bringeth up upon them the waters of the river." This great river spreading over the land is a picture of the Assyrian invasion. "Even the king of Assyria and all his glory. And he shall come up over all his channels and go over all his banks. And he shall pass through Judah. He shall overflow and go over. He shall reach even to the neck." Well, not the head. The king of Assyria did not take Jerusalem in the time of Hezekiah. Later on, that was preserved. and the stretching out of his wings, the illustration used to describe the Assyrian army switches from a flooding river to a great bird, the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel. You see, it's Emmanuel's land. It's Christ's land, Messiah's land. And not all of it can be taken, because the seed royal, the divine seed, is there in that nation, and the nation has to be preserved so that Christ can come. O Emmanuel. And then we could look down to verses 9 and 10, just following. Associate yourselves, Isaiah speaks to Assyria and any other nation that wants to attack. Associate yourselves, O ye people, and ye shall be broken in pieces, ultimately. And give ear, all ye of far countries, gird yourselves, and ye shall be broken in pieces. Gird yourselves, and ye shall be broken in pieces. Take counsel together, and it shall come to naught. Speak the word, and it shall not stand. And look at these wonderful words. For God is with us. You know, in the Hebrew, that's Emmanuel again. For God is with us. Whatever attack comes will not ultimately or wholly succeed because of Emmanuel. He's actually mentioned a third time here. And this time the name is translated for God is with us. But it's because of Emmanuel. But once Emmanuel comes, well then, the Jewish flag is run down. Well, I come back to chapter 8 and running very quickly from verse 15. This is the prediction of Messiah, the distant sign that will come. Emmanuel will be his name. Butter and honey shall he eat. That's royal food. He didn't literally eat royal food, Jesus Christ. He grew up in a poor household. And I imagine that the prophecy gives him royal food just to indicate that he's a very special person. He's more than royal, he's divine. That he may know how to refuse the evil and choose the good, he'll be weaned on royal food. And then this time span is applied to the present, that is, to Ahaz's time. For before the child shall know how to refuse the evil and choose the good, before the child emerges from early infancy, the land that thou abhorrest, Syria, Israel, shall be forsaken of both her kings. But of course Ahaz didn't believe, and therefore he paid the consequences. Verse 17, the Lord shall bring upon thee and upon thy people and upon thy father's house days that have not come from the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, even the king of Assyria. And then there's a graphic description of how the Assyrian army will come and take everything, and there'll be poverty in the land. Verse 21, verse 22, we won't go through all the details, but there'll be poverty, and arable territories will become just a wilderness again, which only hunters can go into, and people cannot walk there in peace. But I come down to chapter 8, and we've time to look at this. Moreover, and then begin our closing applications. Moreover, the Lord said unto me, take thee a great roll, and write in it with a man's pen concerning Meah, Shalal, Hashbaz. Now this is to be the name of Isaiah's second son. And that's a much longer name, and a fascinating name. Swift to the spoil, speedy to the prey, is the most popular poetic translation of it. And so the message of Isaiah is a remnant shall return, but there'll be constant attack, swift to the spoil, speedy to the prey. If you don't trust the Lord, and if you try to solve your national fears and problems by relating to the enemies of God and solving them in a political and material way. And so this becomes the name of Isaiah's second boy. Verse 3, I went unto the prophetess, and she conceived and bare a son. Then said the Lord to me, call his name Meah, Shalal, Hashbaz, for before the child shall have knowledge to cry, my father and my mother, The riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria shall be taken away before the king of Assyria. And so it took place. Two names that really outline the warnings and the ministry of Isaiah. And verse 4 is, there was a two-year campaign of Assyria against Syria and Israel, and they defeated them and brought them back. And Ahaz's plan went radically wrong. Verses 5 and 6. Look at verse 6 of chapter 8. For as much as this people refuseth the waters of Shiloh that go softly. Well, God's warning, Isaiah's preaching, is compared to the calm water supply of Jerusalem, calm and fruitful. But because that beautiful supply, which depicts Isaiah's message, is ignored, well then instead, verse 7, behold, the Lord bringeth up upon them the waters of the river, which we read about, the great invasion of Syria. So verse 11 of chapter 8, Isaiah says, for the Lord spake thus to me with a strong hand, and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people, saying, say ye not a confederacy to all them to whom this people shall say a confederacy. Neither fear ye their fear, nor be afraid. Sanctify the Lord of hosts himself, and let him be your fear. You were told, says Isaiah, not to fear and never to join with your enemies in order to, with God's enemies, in order to defeat your enemies. But you did so. You went ahead. What you should have feared is offending God. Verse 13. Sanctify the Lord of hosts himself, and let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. And if that's the case, verse 14, he shall be for a sanctuary, a home for you, and for a stone of stumbling and for a rock of offence to both the houses of Israel, for a gin, a trap, for a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And many among them shall stumble and fall and be broken and be snared and be taken. Well, sadly, that was the way that Judah went. And that was so often the way that she went. And then there was a remnant. God bless, God had mercy. He brought a remnant, a minority of the people back, or saved them. And he would lead them forward again, and back they would go again, until Christ came. And as I mentioned, the last remnant was gathered out. But look at these verses with which we'll come to our final part. Verse 16. Bind up the testimony. Seal the law among my disciples. Who's speaking? Is it Isaiah? Is it God? Now, here's a mystery here, but it's not difficult to solve, and it's fascinating to do so. Verse 17, it continues, and I will wait upon the Lord that hideth his face from the house of Jacob, and I will look for him. Who is it? Is it Isaiah? Is it God? Verse 18, this sounds like Isaiah. Behold, I and the children whom the Lord hath given me, their names are for signs and for wonders. They're for a message. They're in the place of miracles. If the people would only listen, the names of my boys, could be Isaiah, are telling them what history will be if they're disobedient. They are signs and wonders, just their names, from the Lord of hosts, which dwelleth in Mount Zion. Well, here is a problem. That 18th verse is quoted in the letter to the Hebrews. I won't turn to it now, but in chapter 2 and verse 13, as the words of Messiah. So the New Testament identifies verse 18 of chapter 8 as Christ's words. Well, we say, that's very strange. It looks like Isaiah's words. That's just what he would say. I and the children whom I've been given are as a message, as good as signs and wonders in Israel. So what's the explanation? Well, it is a remarkable example of double sense in prophecy. It is Isaiah speaking, there's no doubt, but it's Isaiah speaking under inspiration like David sometimes does, and the words suit him, and they do apply to him, but they're actually the words of Messiah, of Christ, and they apply much more to him. They're both. Isaiah represents Messiah. So look at them and see how it works, because it's a tremendous message. Beginning in verse 16, bind up the testimony. Initially, it's Isaiah. Seal the law among my disciples. The prophecy of Isaiah must be preserved as scripture. And those who love the Lord, possibly there were disciples in a school of the prophets under Isaiah. We don't read of it, but that was often the case. His close followers and supporters would have had a particular responsibility in preserving his books. And of course they became part of the canon. They were to instruct future generations. And verse 17, and I will wait upon the Lord that hideth his face from the house of Jacob, and I will look for him. So the long wait starts, waiting for the coming of Christ in 700 years' time. This is the message of Isaiah. Seal these prophecies. We now begin the godly, the remnant, the minority. We begin the wait. Behold, I and the children, a remnant shall return, swift to the spoil, speedy to the prey, describing Assyria, and later on Babylon, the Babylonians, and then the Greeks, and then the Romans, the attackers. Behold, I and the children whom the Lord hath given me are as good as for signs and for wonders in Israel, from the Lord of hosts, which dwelleth in Mount Zion. Now we read from verse 16 again, realizing, having been informed by the letter to the Hebrews, that these are actually Christ's words. And he says, bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. This is Holy Scripture with the authority of Christ upon it. It's his words. And I, now look at the meaning of this, I, the Messiah, will wait upon the Lord that hideth his face from the house of Jacob. I will not come. I will not come until the period of God's hiding his face is over. The period of warnings to Judah, repeated deliverances of remnants, warnings again, the long intertestamental period with no prophet, 400 years without blessing, without signs and wonders, without the voice of God. I will wait upon the Lord, says Messiah, that hideth his face from the house of Jacob, and I will look for him when the period is appointed, when the fullness of the times has come, then I will appear. Behold, I and the children, not just Isaiah's children, but my children, are for signs and for wonders in Israel, now Zion, the new church, from the Lord of hosts, which dwelleth in Mount Zion. And it is a case of Isaiah speaking for himself, but the words apply more marvellously to Christ himself, as the letter to the Hebrews indicates. And that's wonderful, that's tremendous, and we understand it in that way. Christ will wait until the period of rejection is over. Now, how does this, it's prophecy, Christ will come. But what is the lesson for the Church of Jesus Christ? Well, we must not be like the Jews, who repeatedly fell into the same traps. And even the professing Christian church often follows the mistakes of the Jews. They were the early days of the New Testament church, and vast numbers of people were saved, and the church was spread among the nations. And then suddenly, the church enters into a confederacy with the world. And there in the period of the Roman Empire, there's that Constantinian Pact, and the church agrees to become the official state religion of Imperial Rome. And it joins hands with the world, and it is its ruin, and its doom, and its downfall. And out of it comes error, and ultimately, of course, the Roman Catholic perversion. They should never have entered into union with the empire. Never, in exchange for certain freedoms, liberties, benefits, and so on. And hindsight tells us that, obviously. Then we get it repeated in history. I won't go through post-Reformation times, different problems and different difficulties, but you think of the Victorian age in this country, and you think of the glories of the 19th century, and the growth of Bible preaching, of evangelicalism, and revival after revival, especially after 1859. And wonderful things, we had the 1859 revival on a large scale here in the Tabernacle. So many people converted week after week. Wonderful things take place. And the devil is scheming, what can I do about this? Remember how I succeeded magnificently in perverting Israel and Judah, generation after generation. Can I not apply these same principles that I used them to bring them down to the Church of Jesus Christ? And of course he did. And the movement for higher criticism came in, which downgraded the Bible. And many, many people joined hands with it. And they said to themselves, well, we must be an educated church, and we must win the intellectuals and the highbrows, and we must give ground to this new intellectual Christianity. We don't like some of its critical attitudes, but it's important to join hands with this. And of course it meant that the great historic denominations, whether Methodists, Baptists, whatever, Congregationalists, Independents, were all brought right down at the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century, so that the vast majority of mainline denominational Christians became liberal. And it happened within the space of about 40, 50 years, the biggest downgrade. It's the same problem as with the Jews of old. If the Christian church starts making confederacies, you know, with those who are the enemies of the Lord and not people of faith, for spurious advantages which never turn out. Remember how Ahaz paid Tiglath-Pileser III with all the treasures from the house of God and the king's house. And he took it and he did something for him, but then promptly conquered him and went for him and raised those buildings to the ground. Well, that's what happens every time. And we have the same thing today. It's different now. There's a different enemy. Now, Bible-loving evangelicals, and many are Bible-loving evangelicals, are being drawn into association with the world. And I keep talking about this because it's so necessary. We make friends with the world, borrow the worldly music. Why, it's dreadful. This last Easter, in this very area of South London, a lot of churches, evangelical churches, though some of them weren't evangelical churches, get together with this Passion for Life thing. And at the Battersea Town Hall, they were all advertising on their websites a great jazz show one Saturday night. And the people they had performing in this were quite secular performers and so on. It was mainline Philadelphia jazz that they brought in, with a bit of a twist on it and a bit of a supposedly Christian message. This idea we can have the culture of the world, and that will make us more, you know, acceptable to people. And they'll come along to our meetings and listen to our gospel. We'll borrow the entertainment, the culture of the world. We'll adapt it, we'll employ it. And there are good people falling into doing this. But it'll be the ruin of the churches. And that's not a preacher's opinion. That's the whole history of the Jews of old, and even so often, sadly, of evangelical believers, Christian believers, over the recent centuries. So we are so anxious about these things and so careful of them. We never accommodate the world. We keep ourselves unspotted from it. We never make friends with the world. Common cause, and use its methods and its techniques or anything of that kind. We believe in the Word and the work of the Spirit, and we must be loyal to Him. And that's one most important lesson we receive from these passages in the book of the prophet Isaiah. Zion, the kingdom of Christ, the great law is faithfulness. We must be faithful to Him. Well, remember, it summarizes Isaiah. Any kind of compromise, it ultimately leads to trouble, and a remnant shall return. And sadly, God's enemies will be swift to the spoil, speedy to the prey, and down will go so many of us. Well, I hope that isn't a gloomy message, because the other side of the coin is that faithfulness leads to blessing and power and advance. Let's close singing the hymn 484.